For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. This episode features Raphael Kushner, considered a leading voice in the world of emotional connection and present moment awareness. With Sounds True, Raphael has released an audio program adapted from his groundbreaking book, The One Thing Holding You Back. Welcome once again to the Self-Acceptance Project. My name is Tammy Simon, and I'm your host. And in this episode, I'm speaking with Raphael Kushner. Welcome, Raphael.
Thank you.
In this series, we're looking at really the challenge that so many of us face, the challenge of how we're unkind to ourselves, especially when something difficult happens. It might be an illness, we discover that we have an illness, or it might be that we discovered that we did something that we feel embarrassed about, or we wished we'd handled that situation differently. We wished we'd said something differently. And I'd love to know, from all the work that you've done, all of your experience teaching and working directly one-on-one with people and in groups, what's your understanding of the roots of our self-hatred, really, our cruelty towards ourselves?
Well, as I take in that question, two different streams come into my consciousness. So I'll address them one at a time. The first one is about what we've come to understand as the brain's negative bias. So it tries to protect us from what it thinks is wrong, either in the world or with us, but especially with us. There's this constant assessing function of how am I doing, and usually that tends pretty quickly towards how am I screwing this up. And the main point here is that it's actually a function that is meant, from an evolutionary perspective, to keep us safe, to allow us to thrive. Just in our world and the way that we've developed at this point in our history, it's just on overdrive and mostly unhelpful. But it is important to recognize that part of our internal feedback system actually thinks that it's doing us good. That if it can just tell us as clearly as possible how and why we suck, then we can get about to fixing that problem so we'll be okay. So it perceives itself as a force for good, even though obviously it's not, and especially not because it's a hamster wheel that we can never get off of, and there's never really a place where that part of ourselves is going to say, yay, you finally arrived, and now we're going to let up. So that's the first part, the negative bias and how that works within us in a way that we actually can't really control by fighting or trying to change in an active way. And we can talk more about, you know, what we can do about that in a moment. And then there's the other stream. And you want me to just jump right into that one as well?
Yeah, please go for it.
Okay. So the other stream is, for most of us, about early wounding. It's about not getting what we needed in terms of core attachment and connection that helped us come to not only understand, but to be organized in our consciousness and in our brains as well, such that we know that we're okay and safe in the world, no matter what we're thinking or feeling. So when we get wounded in one way or another, and most of us do, we get to a place where really at the core, we don't feel that we're okay. And we don't feel that our natural responses to life are worthwhile, good enough, etc. And then at a very young age, when we're completely unconscious of it, we develop one of a number of strategies to try to deal with this hurt, and in many cases, this trauma that lives within us. And the main way is to not actually have the felt experience in our bodies of this wound, which usually shows up as not good enough or rejection or abandonment. And so our consciousness then becomes organized in such a way that we're trying to avoid that feeling. And so when it comes up, once again, we get into this very self-critical mode where it seems like actually we're feeling that feeling or we're coming from that place. But really, in my experience, what's happening is that we're coming from our resistance to that place. The strategy has become do anything at all necessary not to feel what's there in the core. And out of that comes the trance of unworthiness, as it's often called, and all of the different ways that we end up feeling worse, but again, from a strategy point of view, actually think, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, that we're fixing the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, just to underscore one thing, it sounds like both of these strands you're putting into the context of we actually think we're helping ourselves. So even though we're saying under our breath mean things like, oh, you're such an idiot, or you shouldn't have done that, or why, but there's some part of us, whether it's our brain or it's the way that we're avoiding this pain inside of us, we think this is a strategy that's going to work somehow.
I think most of the time that's true. And I think that I'm always talking to people about sort of the three basic ways that we can meet any experience outside of ourselves, for sure, but especially internally. One way, when we have a difficult or challenging emotion around ourselves, either on its own or with a thought or a judgment that's also unpleasant or challenging, one way is to collapse into it, to align with it as if it's the truth of who we are. And there's this sense that, well, why fight it? It is the way that it is. So it seems at that point that there's that positive aspect, even though it's, you know, yucky, but it's that we're just going to stop fighting the truth, so to speak. So in that case, there's a strategy. Another way of looking at it is also that when we collapse into that kind of self-belief and feeling that our awareness is going to sleep, and it's going to sleep within that whole negative self concept. And that sleep is another strategy. It seems like, it would be painful, and why would we want to do it? But that's one version, so collapsing into. And the other version is the opposite, which is fighting or resisting. So when I notice I have a self-critical thought, or when I feel unworthy, you know, and I start to collapse in my shoulders around my chest, I'm saying, no, it's not good. I must develop positive self-esteem. I must learn to judge myself. I mean, not to judge myself. And in that process, actually, we're glued through our fighting to that wound. And we think we're trying to fix it, as you said, and I did as well. But in fact, we're just fueling more battle. And then the third way is really just a neutral noticing without engagement. So oh, there's that negative thought, or, oh, I'm starting to feel a collapse in my chest, or my heart is breaking open, or there's a hole in the center of my being. And it's that neutral response that doesn't come naturally to us, but is where all of the real positive shift comes, in my experience. And the other two, they do masquerade as for our best interest or for our good, and they don't really have the conception of the fallout, or, as I mentioned before, the fact that it's really a hamster wheel and there's no getting to there because it's just going to keep perpetuating.
Mm-hmm. Now I want to talk more about how we can train ourselves in this third response, the noticing, but we'll come back to that. Before we do, I want to make sure we don't drop something here, Raphael, because when I first asked you this question, you said, well, let's begin by talking about the negative bias in the brain. And, you know, I was with you, and this is something in this series on the Self-Acceptance Project that we're hearing from people who have studied the brain, and neuroscientists are reporting this negativity bias. We are trying to protect ourselves. What can we do about that? It sounds like we're sort of destined to be stuck with a brain that interprets the world through the lens of self-protection.
Well, I think it is really great to have learned through research in neuroscience that the brain has a negative bias, but I also think it's something that is really easy to see on the ground and in our daily lives, even without neuroscience. And I love to tell the story about my stepdaughter who, when she was about 6 years old and we went on vacation, I knew about this negative bias, so I wanted to kind of cement in the positive aspect of the experience. And I said, okay, everyone in the family, we're going to go around the circle and we're going to say three things that we loved about our vacation. And she went along with it and she found three things to say. And then as soon as we finished in the circle, she rubbed her hands together with relish and had a kind of a devilish look on her face and said, okay, now can we talk about three things that we hated about our vacation? And that always stuck with me because it leads to an answer to your question, which is that we cannot defeat the negative bias by fighting against it. So the first thing is a kind of a resigned, hopefully with a sense of humor, acceptance of it as it is. So we get the opportunity to do what's relevant in other realms of life too, which is correct for bias. Meaning, I recognize that I'm going to tilt in that direction. So I can correct for it by saying that a clearer view is probably more in the middle. And also, it helps to kind of balance the scale by putting a little bit on the other side. And in that process, I think what happens is that we get the grip of that bias loosened. It doesn't stop happening, but we're less led by it and much more able to adapt to it.
And can you talk to me more personally about what you do to correct this bias in your own experience? How do you work with that?
Well, for me, I try to be as sensitive to thinking and feeling, but also even to go beyond that to an energetic sensitivity. And what I've come to recognize in myself is that when that negative bias is in operation, I get a kind of a hunkered down energy, like it's wrong, it's bad. And it feels to me a little bit like what you see when a dog starts gnawing on a bone. And that energetic state I'm very highly attuned to. And once I notice that it's present, I either almost instantly can relax back into a broader awareness, or I can actually, with a little bit of humor, let it run. You know, okay, well, I'm the dog with the bone. Let me get this all out. Let me gnaw until, you know, my jaw is tired, and then I'll relax back into awareness. But even when I'm letting it run, I'm not believing it with the same intensity that I was a few moments before. So to be very specific in answer to your question, I think more than anything, it's the awareness of what it feels like energetically in my whole being to start looking at things from a what's wrong perspective that I've become more and more over time especially aware of. And that awareness is really, I think, what helps me the most.
And this idea of either collapsing, fighting, or noticing, is there an energetic posture that goes with each one of those that you're also attuned to?
Yes, that's a great question. Absolutely. And, you know, collapsing into already has that sense just in the terms, and so does fighting against. And both of those are something that, you know, if we were even teaching kids in a class about energetic awareness, I mean, I know that's a dream of mine. Maybe it's a fantasy, but just imagine, you know, even at the elementary school age, what does it feel like when you're starting to be very critical of yourself? Or what does it feel like when you're trying to be different than you are? Those are energetic states that we definitely all have the ability to be aware of. But I think the key in answering your question has to do more with the neutral state, because so far I've been doing it a little bit of a disservice by talking about it as just noticing. And what I mean by that is that if we're noticing in a kind of clinical way, I don't think that's so helpful in terms of self-acceptance, which is really what we're here to promote. For me, there has to be a kind of caring. It's not fake. It's not overly sweet. But it's a curiosity that comes from care. And the best way I can describe it is that when there's a parent or anybody who loves a young child and the young child is having a hard time, we want to know more about it. But we also want to know about it in a way that really shows that our investment is in uplifting and supporting this child in coming back to a place of knowing its own goodness, its own safety, and being allowed to relax, therefore. So it's that caring curiosity that is the energetic of the middle way that I've been talking about, which I think is necessary and which makes all the difference.
So, Raphael, the question that's coming up for me listening to you is, once I get to that place of noticing and caring and being curious about what I'm feeling, I'm already into self-acceptance. I'm already a good portion of the way there. What do you recommend when you're not there yet? Do you know what I mean? When you're in the throes of really just feeling so upset about something and you kind of can't think straight. You can't notice the energy. You just feel terrible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's maybe a premise in the question that I would wonder about.
Yeah.
Because what I find is that we are never more than a split second away from having awareness in general. And then once we have an awareness, we can also shift the energetic or the quality of that awareness. So let me just give you an example of that that might really hit home for people watching this. You know, I've worked with those who are in a full-blown panic state. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, you know, I'm terrible, the trance of unworthiness, but it's, you know, get me to a hospital, I'm dying. And we don't have time to get into how someone's negative self-concept and self-experience could lead to something like that. But let's do a shorthand, which is to say, from my experience, anxiety is really a diversionary tactic from a feeling that our feedback system has actually deemed worse than that panic. So it's odd to say, but this, even at the intense level of take me to the hospital, I'm dying, it's actually really so I don't feel something like unworthiness or the abandonment that is the core wound we were talking about earlier. But it shows up in this dramatic way, which makes it seem like it's a five-alarm blaze. How could you have any kind of awareness in the middle of that, kind of what you're describing, when everything just is absolutely terrible? But in those moments, my job, as I see it when I sit with people, is to say, okay, just right now in this moment, you're having this panic, but how is it manifesting for you? What are you actually noticing in this very moment? And that's the instantaneous shift that I described, because the witness, as we understand from our spiritual traditions, never goes away. It's just obscured temporarily. So that question, most of the time, can take someone right back instantly into the witness. And if someone reports to me that it feels like my heart is pounding like this, you know, and I'm trembling, and I'm dying, I'll say, okay, let's hold off on the dying part, because that's the interpretation, but spend a few more moments with this absolutely overwhelming, pounding heart, and this dizziness, and this tied up in knots that you feel in your stomach. And with some support, and just a short amount of time, what I see mostly is that a person shifts out of panic into experience held by awareness, which then brings up emotion. A person is therefore in connection to his or her emotion, and what's most important in that is that they're no longer in panic, and they can see that. If I point it out, they say, yes, right now I'm desperately sad, but I'm not in panic. So I wanted to use that as an example, Tammy, because it's about as intense as things get. And in the middle of that intensity, I've seen over and over again how people can come right back to that witnessing place. And maybe the most heartening thing I can share about it is that when you're in the deepest and the darkest and the worst, and when it seems like self-acceptance is the farthest away, you are, in fact, just that one instant away from your awareness that can transform it completely.
Now, in the example that you gave, you're working with another person. So there's the two of you, and you're helping this person through a process. How would you advise somebody on how they could work with themselves?
Well, I think the first thing to say about that is that we are really not meant to do it alone. And we actually can often only come to a place of greater awareness and peace through our connection with others. Not necessarily in a professional only capacity, but we have to have the space held with us often. So I don't want to go into the how can one do it oneself right away without giving lots of airtime to the idea that we aren't meant to do it alone. And, in this series, you're probably talking to at least one or more neuroscience-oriented people who are talking about the intersubjective space, what arises between me and another person, and how that often even informs who I am, not just how I get out of trouble when I'm in it. So I really believe in that space, and believe that when we go into a I must do it alone, or I am alone, or I have to pull myself up by my bootstraps, but that is all debilitating. And so I want to really emphasize the way that we need to be in connection. Mm-hmm. But once we get that, we also need to take what comes from that connection and begin to bring in what we've been outsourcing temporarily in that other person's holding and reflection. So strengthening our ability to hold our experience, whether we're beginners in the process or whether we're advanced practitioners, is really always where it's at from my point of view. Because even when we are far along the path, there's one or two or three experiences in life, and I would consider them to be all emotional, that we say no to still. And because they overwhelm us, we haven't been able yet to say yes. We might want to, but we can't. And that, to me, is the essence of the healing path and even the spiritual journey, is finding those places inside of ourselves where we've said no and beginning not to try to say yes, but just to cultivate a space of awareness in which we can hold the experience, so that even in the heart of it, we know it is not who we are and is not defining us. So coming back again to the direct question you asked, when we're on our own, for me, it's all about that. And it's becoming a student of where I still say no. That is the where the the lever, so to speak, is that's going to give me the greatest possible growth and healing going forward.
Now, I know a lot of your work, Raphael, directs people actually to their somatic experience and the somatic experience of no to a certain emotion or experience. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, first of all of the things we're saying no to are in our bodies. So that's the somatic piece. There's nowhere else we're going to find them because they arise as emotions. And then when we don't feel them, they don't go away. They stay in our bodies, but they're part of our unconscious trying to get our attention. And then they're constantly, as they're trying to get our attention, met by the no. And the no is both a physical contraction, literally, in our bodies. So for me, my shoulders like to climb up to my ears. For someone else, it might be a tightening in the belly. We each have different ways of contracting. And then it's also an energetic, like we were talking about before. So for me, in my own life and in my work with clients, we're looking for all of that. But especially we're looking for the physical contraction, because the physical contraction is actually the telltale sign that a part of our brain that usually runs on automatic pilot has shut us down. Sometimes, you know, it might be called the primitive brain. Other people using more advanced terminology might call it an amygdala hijack. But the point is that it's literally created an encasement around the difficult or painful feeling in our body. And the amazing and wonderful thing about that, even though it's very painful, is that when we bring this kind of caring and curious attention to the actual physiological manifestation of that contraction, it opens. Always. Because what's happening is that we're bringing a higher function to an automatic response. And that part of ourselves that creates the automatic response is super powerful, but it also knows it's not the boss and that it has to listen. So it kind of stands back and says, I don't know, what's going on here? I'm not sure I like this. Okay, if you want to do that, if you want to bring your attention, I'll let that happen. And I reserve the right to shut down the show at any moment, but it still lets that happen. And then we start having a different experience. And when we have a different experience, then that part of ourselves that creates the automatic shutdown, it updates and it realizes, oh, this isn't life-threatening, so I don't have to shut down like I did before. And again, to come back to the heart of your question, this happens in the body. So the contraction arises in the body and the release arises in the body. So that's why it's so important when we're using this caring and curious attention to turn it to the experience in our body. It's not something that if we turn to our thinking, we can get much traction with. And certainly when we look outside and try to change our external situation, we don't get much traction with that either. But when we turn that attention to our body, that's where all the magic happens.
Now, Raphael, you're actually the first person that I've talked to in this series who's brought up this idea of, at least explicitly, the intersubjective space and what happens when we're with another person and how that affects our self-loathing or feelings of negativity towards ourselves. How, you know, I know there are certain people when I'm with them and I totally relax. No matter what, I just, you know, I can be talking to them on the phone or, you know, 5 feet away, having a conversation, anything. And I wonder if you could say more about that. And also if you might recommend to people sometimes that if they find themselves in the throes of being unkind to themselves, if there's a certain way they could reach out to other people that would be effective.
Yeah, so let's go to the first part of it. I think everybody without any kind of advanced knowledge or special jargon knows that we're not skin encapsulated beings, because you walk into a room and two people have just had a fight and they're not even facing you and you know something's up. So our way of being in the world, while it seems like we're walking around and we're constrained and confined by our physical space, it actually even at a very young age, we come to be aware isn't the case. And in fact, we find ourselves in the space between much of the time. So that's really relevant here, because what often we might do is seek out people who are going to try to make us feel better. And I don't think that's so helpful. I think it's actually helpful to seek out people who will support us in feeling more. That's one part of it. And then also people who really live and promote through their awareness the idea that there is nothing wrong, that there's nothing wrong with them, there's nothing wrong with us. And that doesn't mean that there aren't issues in our own personal lives and in the world at large that need all kinds of attention to shift and change. It's not that. It's the state of an acceptance of what is right now. So when you're sitting with someone who is exuding with every pore of their body that there is nothing wrong with you, there's nothing wrong with you in the pain that you're experiencing, there's nothing wrong with you even in the self-criticism that's running through your mind, this is the thing, I think, for most of us that allows us to exhale the way you were describing. If I'm trying to get you to feel better, then I'm joining with you in a certain way in saying that there's something wrong with how you feel. So going back to the second part of your question, which is how would I reach out? I would use that as the barometer. I would notice how I feel around people that I'm connecting with when I'm in difficulty, whether they're professional or not. And if they're giving me the sense that I was just describing, that there's room for all of this, and yes, we can work on it, we can look at it together, but you're okay. You're fundamentally okay. That's for me the gold standard. That's what I would trust when I'm choosing who to reach out to and when.
And Raphael, I just have one final question for you, which is that I know that sometimes when people are ill or they have something challenging going on with their health, that that's one of the hardest times to be kind to oneself. You feel like your body isn't there for you in the way you want it to be, and you're not at your best. And I know that you've worked with challenging health issues throughout your life, and I'm curious what you could tell our listeners about self-acceptance when you're not feeling well.
That's a really great question, and you're absolutely right. For something close to 30 years, I've had what is usually referred to as chronic fatigue syndrome, which is a synonym for we don't really know exactly what's going on with you. But it's something that I live with every day, and it shapes my functioning every day, when how much time I have to be in a high function like this talking to you, and how much time I have to be either in feeling bad or in recovering. And I think that the most important piece about that is that we start, most of us, with the idea that we're supposed to be in good health, that our bodies are supposed to function in a way that feels either good or that we're not even having to pay attention to because they're just doing their thing so that we can put our attention elsewhere. So that when our bodies start to quote unquote fail us, we definitely come into the state that something is wrong. And sometimes it becomes self-blame, we've created this, and sometimes it becomes anger at God, why do I have to feel this way? But the overall thing that's bringing it all together is the idea that there is something wrong. And for me, over the years, as I've gotten more and more peaceful around my physical symptoms, it's because I don't have an expectation or a need that my body function in a particular way, so that when it's not functioning optimally, I'm not collapsing into or fighting it. I'm just asking myself, what is available here? So, for example, last weekend I was giving some talks at a college, and it was a great group. I was really excited to be there. But as a part of my physical symptoms, I had a terrible headache. And for many people, the headache might be the kind of thing which would have to cause them to cancel the experience. But instead, I chose to have an experience called wonderful teaching at college with terrible headache. And that's the way it was. And it wasn't my preference that it be that way, but I just knew that there was nothing that I was going to do that was going to exacerbate that. And coming back to the core of what I'm sharing, it's that the idea that something is wrong, especially when we're dealing with our bodies, really limits the ability that we can, with which we can care for ourselves and accept ourselves. And so again, for me, that's where the greatest shift can be, is to go from to okay, what's the very best thing I can do to support myself in this very moment? And in that experience I described, it was just to take it one moment at a time, to recognize that the headache was going to be present until it wasn't. And that gave me just enough space to get through what I was there to do.
And just a final question. Do you have like an on-the-spot set of techniques you use, like in a situation like this? Do you ask a specific question like, what if nothing were wrong? Or a way that you sort of drop into your body, or other things like that, that are sort of your on-the-spot toolbox?
I do. And so, you know, most of my work, which you're aware of, has to do with what I call surfing the sensations inside of our body, and also similarly turning our attention to our thoughts and also to the energetic that we spoke about earlier. But really, in the worst situations or the most challenging ones, I come back to the two basic questions that set me to surfing, so to speak. The first question is, what is happening right now? And that's so important, because it's not my story about what's going to happen in 5 minutes if this headache doesn't go away. And it's not, what did I eat to bring about this headache? But what is happening right now? And then, even though I don't add this to the sentence, what I'm really meaning is in my body. So what is happening right now? I turn my attention to my body. And once I notice what is happening, I ask the second of the two questions, which is, can I be with it? Which is just to say, kind of summing up everything from our conversation today, can I allow this to be exactly as it is and move and shift and change along with it in a non-interfering way? Can I let it be caring and attentive without trying to change it or even to understand it? So really those two questions, what is happening right now and can I be with it, are really the synthesis of everything we've been talking about today. And even after many decades of going through this kind of experience, I come back to them again and again. And I don't actually have to, after many years, say the words out loud to myself. The first question, what is happening right now, is the invitation to turn to my body. And then the second question, can I be with it, really just becomes an embracing of what I find. And that's my core practice in every moment. And it's actually my core practice not only when I'm losing self-acceptance or when I'm in pain or where I feel like something's wrong. It's also my core practice when I'm feeling awesome and wonderful, because when I use that practice, it just puts me deeper into connection with all that is. And it's the most freeing and peaceful and joyful experience that I know. So those two questions are my toolkit.
Wonderful. Thank you, Raphael. Thanks for being part of this investigative series of interviews on self-acceptance. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure to be with you. And I just want to say one thing, which is, anybody has any questions about any of this from listening to our conversation today, I would invite them to email me. I'll respond to them personally, I promise.
And they should email you at?
RC, my initials, at Kushner, my last name, CUSHNIR.com.
There you go. Ask Raphael your questions. And with Sounds True, if you're interested in knowing more about Raphael's work, he's created an audio program called The One Thing Holding You Back. And it's a program that includes teachings and practices to help you feel fully and release resisted emotions. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.